citizens to address the committee on each item under committee matters shown on this agenda or added to the agenda by the committee. Individuals who wish to address the committee are asked to note the following. On each committee matter on the committee's agenda, the chair will seek public comment upon the completion of staff's presentation. Each person shall state their name. All statements and questions shall be directed to the chairperson. Presentations will be limited to 10 minutes. Persons wishing to address the committee a second time will be given the opportunity to do so once all others in attendance have had the opportunity to address the committee. Persons addressing the committee for a second time shall limit their presentations to 5 minutes. Since at this time we're not having in-person public attendance, any citizen wishing to address the committee may use the chat function on Facebook Live, which is monitored by staff. Anyone wishing to address the committee on a matter not included on this agenda can have the matter added to the next meeting's agenda by contacting Jeff Merrill, Director of Planning and Development Services, at 902-521-0925. Or by email at planning@modl.ca. Next is the approval of the agenda or any other items to be added.
I'll approve the agenda.
Second.
So Councillor Oikle made a motion, seconded by Mayor Bolivar Gadsden. All in favor? And on Facebook, I guess we need on the we'll need you to indicate either by a raised hand or I need to see you. Okay. So, motion carried. Approval of minutes of Thursday, February 24th, 2022. I need a motion for approval. Am I saying that right?
I so move.
Do you so move? Moved by Councillor Greek and seconded by Councillor DeLong. All in favor? Motion carried. Business arising from minutes.
Just give an update to the Planning Advisory Committee. So the matter that you guys spoke to last meeting about the Osprey Village planning documents, those were forwarded to Municipal Council, and Council has done their first reading. And there is a public hearing on April 12th? Yep. For that, after Council does their public hearing, they'll be able to do second reading and approve those documents. Council also supported the motion from the Planning Advisory Committee to direct staff to explore affordable housing options in the municipality, such as the inclusionary zoning, affordable housing cash in lieu, and density bonus. Zoning. That's the update from. That's the business arising from the minutes.
Thank you very much. And now we move on to Planning Advisory Committee matters, which would be Mr. Kang. I'm sorry. Have we not? We didn't address the business rising from minutes 5.2 short-term rental policy update.
We were going to do that one next. If you would like to deal with 5.1, the engagement policy program, and Mr.
Yes,
Kang
right.
has prepared a presentation.
Okay. And okay, thank you. Sorry, it's 5.1 that we're dealing with first, which is policy 066A, engagement policy program.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good evening to the committee members for an opportunity for me to speak tonight in front of the Planning Advisory Committee. This is a proposed amendment to the public engagement policy in order to specify the process to engage with our neighboring municipalities if a planning amendment happens in that municipality, like the previous item that we discussed at the last meeting regarding Austria Village planning amendment. Before I speak about the specific amendment, I'd like to show you the big picture, because this amendment is actually a part of the five-year review process of our public engagement policy. The first phase was finished in July 2020, and that was about communicating with our residents and landowners within our municipality. This is mandated in the Municipal Government Act as the public participation program, and this is the time we formally introduced new policy direction, such as the so-called the reverse pyramid scheme, where the municipality conducts an extensive public engagement at the very beginning of the planning process, instead of leaving it up to the very end and right before a public hearing. We also introduced a new initiative, like conducting online engagement. The second phase, which is what we will be talking about tonight, is communicating with our neighboring municipalities. It is also mandated by the province as part of the engagement program. The third phrase is talking about communicating our right shoulder, recognizing that we are on Mi'kma'ki, the ancestral and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people. So the municipal staff has been meeting with the Akiti First Nation folks to find out the preferred method and the level of engagement between the two parties. We're also exploring the possibility of collaboration, such as in identifying sacred places, having a conversation on sustainable development practices, and researching the history before 750 with the Mi'kmaq elders. I will have to save the best piece for last later date, but Steph will follow up once phase three is complete. But for now, phase two. At the moment, a municipality is not obligated to consult with its neighbors. The only section in the MGA states that we have to notify a public hearing at least 2 weeks before it occurs. And the keyword here is to notify. It's not to consult or to engage. And because of that, what really happened was that by the time we received a notice from our neighbors regarding any type of planning amendment, it would be way too late for us to make an influence to their final decision. And this is why the province introduced the legislation to change this in 2018. They have mandated a few things, such as that the municipality must solicit comments, and if the comments are received, we need to consider those comments from the neighboring municipality every time there's a change to the municipal planning strategy. So this whole process it must be completed at least 2 weeks before a public hearing occurs, while a municipality may able to restrict the areas of notification and types of planning amendments to be notified, we must at minimum solicit comments about the five statements of provincial interest. So a good example would be protection of drinking water policy, where all three towns around us, they rely upon us for their water sources. But here in Lunenburg County, due to our interconnectedness, we decided to go above and beyond the provincial requirement. All five municipalities came together in order to form an ad hoc staff committee to come up with a policy document together. So after a few meetings and exchange of ideas, the staff task force came up with the five guiding principles. We decided to expand our scope from just the municipal planning strategy to include land use bylaw, subdivision bylaw, and development agreement, and the notice will be given at the same time as the public receives a notice about the first public information meeting. So those notices will be forwarded to our clerk as well as the our planning director. We also decided on the notification distance, realizing that not all planning amendments needs to be informed. So for example, if there's a planning item about a HEP bill, Bridgewater may be more engaged than, say, Mahone Bay or Chester. The distance will be based on proximity to the neighboring municipalities, which will be shown in the map momentarily. However, if a planning amendment is about something significant, such as drinking water, flood risk, or housing policy, we will notify all four other units in Lunenburg County.
And we have a question by Councilor Oracle.
Mr. Kang, through our chair, could you tell me what those initials all stand for? The MPS, the SPS, the LUM, the SB, the DA?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for those wonderful questions. I will say again that it stands for Municipal Planning Strategy, Secondary Planning Strategy. So currently in our municipality, we have 8 of them, so including the village of Hepville, say like Oakland, places in that, and so on. LUB stands for Land Use Bylaws. SB stands for Subdivision Bylaw. And the DA also stands for Development Agreement, which we have several in our municipality.
Thank you, Mr. Kang. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So moving on. So if a comment is not received by any other municipality, it will be deemed as no objection. If a comment is received, then it will be considered at this planning advisory committee level, or at the latest at the first reading of council. And first reading of council, that is the deadline for soliciting comments. If we get a comment from another municipality past the first reading of council, then it will be too late. It will be past the deadline. In addition to phase 2, staff is proposing minor changes to phase 1 as well. And the idea is to solidify those new policies that worked and also to improve those policies that may have not performed as well. So we're making the online engagement through our website and currently on Facebook Live mandatory. And that's on top of other traditional methods of engagement. We're also mandating stakeholder engagement, so with external government agencies such as police, fire, EHS, the Provincial Department of Environment and Public Works. We're also solidifying our reverse pyramid scheme of engagement, where hosting at least one public session before the Planning Advisory Committee is now becoming mandatory. We're also reducing the notice period of that session from 14-day notice to 5-day notice, as we want to focus on the quality of engagement rather than the quantity of engagement. So in other words, a 6-month engagement session may not be necessarily better than a 1-month intensive engagement. Again, we want to focus on the quality when we do engagement with the public as well as the neighboring municipality. And also because of our council meetings are on Tuesday, but our local newspaper is published on Wednesday, when our policy says the 14-day notice period, it realistically becomes 28 days in practice. We want to make sure there is a good balance between the level of engagement as well as the service standard for applicants such as landowners and developer in our community. And now the map. So essentially, if a community boundary is touching or very close to another municipal boundary, it will be included in the notification area. I will also note that some of the community are in more than one area, like the communal clearland, where it faces both Mahone Bay and Chester as well. So if I zoom in a little bit closer to the town. So here's what it looks like around the Bridgewater in Mahone Bay. So if you're within this colored area, you're in the notification distance. If you don't see any colors, then there's no requirement for sending a notice to the other municipal unit because you'd be too far away.
We have a question from Councillor Oracle.
Are these also for our municipalities like the Chester, the Valley, and Queens?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. So I will actually go back a slide. So you see this on the left side of the map. You see the emerald color deck that includes, you know, communities like New Elm, Malaga Lake, and so the western bordering communities, like the notification system for Queens Regional Municipality. And same idea for Kings County, Annapolis County, as well as District of Chester. Yeah. So, yes.
Another question? Supplemental. So then it would be 500 meters into theirs if it was something that we were doing on our side. Is that correct? Is that how that works?
Mr. Kay?
Yes. Thank you again for the question. That is correct. So it is any community that is within 500 meters from the municipal border.
We have another question by Mayor Bollinger-Gatson.
So I believe, if you look at New Elm, for example, on the map, the western side, so those communities, you would notify Queens, or would Queens notify us, or is it just the back and forth? If something was changing in the planning.
Mr. Kang?
Thank you again for the question. That's a very good question. So this colored zone is for our planning document. If our planning document that impacts, for example, New Elm were to change, then we will notify the Queens Regional Municipality. And I will talk about what the other municipality is doing in the next few slides.
Thank you, Mr. Kang. Please continue.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. So see the towns of Bridgewater, Mahon Bay. And if we move down a little bit to the south, you see the towns of Lunenburg here. Notice how Hancock Islands are also on the Chester notification area, as highlighted. So now for the other municipalities, let's take a look at the Chester. So this is the map that is provided to us by the municipal staff at the District of Chester. So in Chester, I'm going to start from the top. So Franny's Corner, 40s, Beech Hill, Gull River, Martin's Point, as well as Blandford are included in the notification district. So what that means is that if any of the planning amendments or any of the planning activity were to occur, say in Blandford or Martin's River, then we will be notified all long before their public information meetings were to begin. So we are well ahead. We'll be notified well ahead. So if council or the PAC has any comment, then we will have ample amount of time for think about it and provide feedback to the Chester Municipal Council. For the town of Bridgewater, all properties within 500 meters from the MODL boundary are included as part of their notification distance to the MODL. For towns of Lunenburg and Mahon Bay, instead of going with the 500-meter distance, they decide to include their entire town area because when we calculated the 500-meter buffer distance, it covered more than two-thirds of the town. So they decided to, why don't we be consistent? Let's just include the whole town. So that's how the conversation has ended. Okay, so should the planning advisory committee wishes to move forward with the recommendation, the council will be notified on April 12th, and which then they can make a final approval on April 26th. Because this is a policy, not a bylaw, the proposed bill will be effective immediately after if the council approves it on April 26th. There is a second component to this, but it will be discussed at a later date because it will be as part of the MODL 2040 projects. So with that, I would like to ask Madam Chair if any public or the committee members have any questions before moving on to the debate. Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions? And I guess I'm asking about from Facebook Live as well.
There's no comments from Facebook.
Mr. King, I think I have one, and perhaps I've gotten ahead of myself, but I thought I read somewhere in sections 9 and 10 that there was a mandatory posting of newspaper advertisements. Is that for, am I looking at the wrong one? I'm looking on page 2 here. And perhaps I'm looking at the, perhaps I've made a mistake. But I see here it says, removes a mandatory posting of newspaper advertisements for a public information session and planning advisory committee meetings. Hearings still will be advertised in a local paper. Staff may still choose to advertise. May also serve to residents near a proposed site.
It's how we notify them.
Yes. So, but we're removing the mandatory part?
Oh, okay. Now I get the question. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So on our previous, or I should say existing policy, it has been mandated that we notify that we are having a public information meeting and a PAC meeting via newspaper. And then the online advertisement was discretionary. We can do it. We don't have to do it. We've been doing it anyway, of course, the staff, because we'd like to reach the as wide audience as possible. So what the proposal here is present right now is that we're almost flipping it. We're making the online mandatory, but we're making the newspaper requirement discretionary. Having said that, now, our municipal policy cannot supersede the provincial requirement, and in the provincial act and regulation, there are certain meetings and the time during the planning process where we are mandated regardless of what we put in our municipal policy, and that's why, well, if the provincial legislation would mandate the newspaper advertisement, it's a duplicate thing that I thought. So staff decided that let's be consistent with the provincial requirement, but we would like to go above and beyond so that not that we're not doing a traditional or newspaper advertisement, but we would like to do both the newspaper and online advertising at the same time, so that we reach the wide audience of the public members in our municipality.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I was just concerned because, like, for me, I'm not a, I don't, no offense to Facebook, but, you know, I'd rather see it in the paper. Yes, and I have a question from Mayor Bolivar-Getson.
And again, my concern would be it's one thing to be going that way, and once we have the municipality 99% connected, that's fine. But in the meantime, we have to make sure that our residents have every opportunity to be engaged. And right now, we're not there yet with that connectivity. So the newspaper advertisements are still quite important from that perspective.
Mr. King, do you have a comment?
Just agreeing that just staff is in agreement with that statement, because we are aware that the municipality has been really working hard towards the rural internet program, but that's still a few years away, and there's still a lot of residents who do not even have access to say cell phone or data, because I get calls saying that can we get the paper copy of the what we're talking about at the planning advisory level, and staff does provide such copy, and then with the recent changes to the fees policy review, council has removed the fee the fees for the printing for those residents who request the paper copy of the planning documents, as they have no online access. So I think so staff would like to work in conjunction with that. So again, we're not getting rid of the newspaper requirement. Staff will do it anyway, whether or not there's a policy or legislative requirement or not. It's just that we want to do, again, both the traditional and the new method of engagement at the same time.
Okay. Thank you for clarification. So we're looking for a motion, right?
Yeah, if there's no other questions.
Is there any other further questions? And nothing, and could you just check the chat? I think that was from previous, though, please. Okay. Just in case. Okay, so now we're looking for a motion. I'm just looking for the motion where it is here. Yes. Councillor Oakle, please read the motion.
To our chair and fellow committee members, I move that the Planning Advisory Committee recommend Municipal Council to adopt Policy 066A, the Engagement Program Policy, as stated in Appendix B of the staff report on February the 24th, 2022. And I so move.
And seconded by Mayor Bolivar Getson. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, all in favor, motion passed unanimously. Okay, on to 5.2, short-term rental policy update. Is that Mr. Kang as well?
Yeah, so we've hired, Darren, did you want to give him an introduction? Do you want to go ahead? You're reaching for the button while I was talking.
I'm ready. Thank you very much, Jeff. Good evening, Council Committee. My pleasure to introduce Craig Gornell tonight. He's a Dalhousie student doing his Bachelor of Community Design, BCD, yes. And just about to finishing up a semester, and he's been working with us all semester on short-term rentals. So based on the conversation we had at our last meeting, we thought this would be an opportune time to bring his research forward and give the committee a little more information on that topic. So I'll pass it over to Craig now.
Thanks, Jeff. Again, my name is Craig Gornell, and I had the fortunate circumstance of listening to the debate last week or at the last PAC meeting on short-term rentals. And I was fairly inspired about how passionate the debate was. It was pretty exciting to watch. But nonetheless, we'll move forward. Yep. Slides are on the go. Okay, great. Short-term rentals. So just an agenda for the evening. First, we'll review the decisions made at last week's PAC meeting. And then we'll move on to defining and identifying a problem here in Modal with short-term rentals. And then moving through that, we'll get onto the Modal-specific context and other concerns with short-term rentals, along with the Nova Scotia regulatory context, and address options and solutions, perhaps, within the Modal context. And then we'll move on to concerns heard from the previous PAC meeting and look at other ways municipalities have addressed these same issues. So, as for the decisions made at the last Planning Advisory Council, PAC recommended prohibiting short-term rentals in high and medium-density residential zones in Osprey Village development area. There was a question asked at the beginning of the presentation at the last PAC to me, what exactly are short-term rentals? So, if you do Google short-term rentals, you'll see a few different definitions out there. The TARA, or the Tourist Accommodation Registration Act, has one where it designates roofed accommodations to a single party or group for payment or compensation for a period of 28 days or less. And if you look at the CMHC definition, you'll see more stringent kind of a definition where it even imposes a maximum of 128 days of the fiscal year that these things can be rented to be deemed a short-term rental. Now, the modal-specific context for long-term rentals versus short-term rentals, you can see here from the graph that of the entire home short-term rentals in the modal area, they occupy 20% of the allowable rental stock in the municipality. So it's a fairly large portion of rental stock that would make a fairly significant contribution had it be returned back to the long-term rental stock. Modal is not alone, of course.
I have a question by Councillor Greek.
If we go back a slide, at the bottom it says 2016. Is that the most recent data that we have for MODL for rentals, 2016?
Yeah. Thank you for the question. Yes, it is. It will be for Statistics Canada. We're expecting new data this year, actually, for 2020. I think Byung Jun may know when it's
July
coming.
Of this year.
July of this year. So there'll be more updated statistics then.
And Councillor DeLong?
Thank you, and through the chair.
So you say that this represents a chunk that could be returned to the long-term rental market, but is there any guarantee that that would happen? What control do we actually have over that, given that it's private homeowners for the most part?
Thank you again for the question. We're going to get to that later on in the regulatory context that came down from Nova Scotia as well.
Please continue, Mr. Warnow.
Thank you. Like I was mentioning, Modal is certainly not alone with this fairly large contrast of short-term rentals to the long-term rental stock. We see other municipalities like Chester in the region of Queens who also have a fairly high stock of short-term rentals, kind of depleting the long-term rental stock in the area. All of the long-term or the short-term rental data that I've gathered so far is from a site called AirDNA at this point.
I'm sorry, Mr. Warnow. We have a question by Mayor of Oliver Gatson.
And this is 2016, but do we know the month, or is this the average?
Is this
at a point in time, or is this?
Yes, this would be for a peak season, so through.
Peak season
through the summer months.
So it's way out of whack.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily out of whack. It's just, it's kind of like an extreme measurement of what the worst case scenario would be, because the other times of the year these units are sitting empty. So the way this was measured would be at peak season, so and they're only rented for a certain percentage of time. Move on to the next one.
Mr. Warnow, please continue.
Thank you. So here we see a provincial monthly comparison of short-term rental revenue versus long-term rental revenue. And this is kind of the justification for the increase that we're seeing in these short-term rentals. Again, we see the data is from StatsCan in 2016, which is the median monthly cost for a rented dwelling. We have an updated statistic of that from the CMHC in the year 2021 that gives the median rent in Nova Scotia at just over $1,100. But we still see almost three times the revenue generated from short-term rentals.
I have a question by Mayor Oliver Gatson.
Just back to that slide. That's per month, but do we know how many days the short-term rental was actually rented? Because we know the blue is a month.
Yeah, Mr. Warren.
So the green that you see here on the graph is a monthly statistic, and that would be rented upwards of 93% of the month, and then on the low end, I believe that came in around 63 to 64% of the month.
Question with Councillor DeLong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 750 per month seems like a low rental average. Is that that's from StatsCan as well, so presumably is correct? Okay. Seems low.
Mr. Warnow?
Yeah, that was from 2016 as well. So, again, we don't have the StatsCan data at this point.
Any other questions? Okay. Please continue, Mr. Warnow.
Just a little more on short-term rentals. So from the Housing and Supply Demand Assessment that Byung-Jit completed in 2020, there's an estimated 350 active short-term rentals estimated for the year 2023. The number of short-term rentals is increasing, three times that of long-term rental stock here in Modal. And the short-term rental market in Modal continues its rapid growth, and that's going to increase the core housing need within the municipality. And from my research, I found that it's quite clearly the vulnerable population here in Modal that will suffer first from the low housing stock. Now,
Mr. Warnow, we have one question from Mr. McRack.
You're on mute.
Sorry, there was no question posed from me. I don't know why you had that indication.
Oh, sorry, we saw that you had your hand up. You could do Control Shift K.
Okay.
Should put that down.
My apologies, Mr. Warnow.
Thank you. So we can shift to the next slide. Now this is getting to the regulatory context. So we've already mentioned the TERRA. which is the Tourist Accommodation and Registration Act. So this is seen as one of the main reasons for the expedited growth of short-term rentals here in Nova Scotia. And this was deemed necessary by the Department of Economic Development, who saw the need for more short-term rentals to kind of supplement the growth of the tourist industry here in Nova Scotia. To move further into the regulatory context, there's an Assessment Act here in Nova Scotia that redesignated short-term rentals to be residential properties instead of commercial dwellings. And so subsection 47A, subsection 2, states that notwithstanding any other provision in this act, a small-scale residential tourist accommodation establishment is a residential property. And there's other establishment regulations that provide some more stringent information on this. So provided an overnight sleeping accommodation is four or fewer, will be deemed a residential property. So, for example, if you bought a six-bedroom house, you rented four units and designated those as short-term rentals, there's no need to register with the province of Nova Scotia, and you wouldn't be charged commercial tax. And then moving through the Municipal Government Act, it's the content of land use bylaw in section 220, and then there's also powers to make bylaws, which I'm sure you guys are well aware of, but in section 172 and subsection 2 designates the primary tools for regulation is land use bylaws within municipalities. And this, unfortunately, does not include any explicit language on short-term rentals at this point. However, it does contain language to regulate specific activities of use within a municipality, along with conditions and terms and other uses of land and licensing. Moving forward through the municipal planning requirements, a municipality may include municipal planning strategy statements of policy on land use. And this deems that statements of policy referred to in subsection 1 may be more stringent than any other enactment. So Byung Jun and I had a pretty great conversation. I believe you guys were also attended a conference on the concepts of guilt and shame. I found that I'm not sure I can do it justice, Byung Jun, but did you want to? I'll take it. Anyway, but so the concepts of guilt and shame, shaming a land use obviously is something that isn't inherently correct within a municipality. So instead of shaming the land use and condemning those who are actively participating in the short-term rental market, we should move into something more that's more focused on conflict management. And so the Municipal Government Act allows addressing the outcome of a land use, but of course municipalities are not allowed to prohibit land use through the entirety of the municipality. So we already saw an example of this in Hempford Forest. Byung Jun and I had a discussion about this, where the land use bylaw prohibits short-term rentals in all zones unless the host lives in proximity to the short-term rentals. This is enforced, of course, through land use bylaws, where it mandates that the host must be the primary residence of the home, and the host is a full-time residence of the plan area. So this is kind of an extreme example of a definitive success in regulating short-term rentals. Of course, the city of Vancouver is much larger than Modal, but their monitoring and the success in the policies that they've created so far are quite wonderful. The total number of 2020 short-term business license were issued was just over 3,500, and that kind of goes towards them improving their rental situation in Vancouver, because previous to this, or these policies that they would have implemented in 2018, they had a little over 6,500 short-term rental units taking up entire home rental stock within the municipality, and upon this implementation of bylaws and regulations, they've cut that almost in half, returning the rest of the stock to the long-term rental market. And some of the questions they've asked to enforce these policies are, what are short-term rentals? How can we define those within our municipal context or our city context? Who can operate short-term rentals? Where can be operated? What licensing is necessary? And other mandates for compliance. Now, I guess enforcement would most definitely be the hot-button issue here in Modal, where there isn't as many options as there would be in a city like Vancouver. So you can see of other enforcement policies, there's an internal registration system created within the city, and, of course, these are bylaw-driven. Now moving on to what we heard at the last PAC meeting. We heard that there was a prevalence of misuse of properties, so we heard a lot of complaints about parties, mistreatment of properties. Investment from outside of Modal and short-term rental markets was a concern. Nuisance calls to emergency services and counselors. And short-term, this was a very interesting comment. So short-term rentals will hasten the changing dynamics of the community and don't provide any contribution to the housing need in Modal. And I found it pretty interesting, all my research looking through Airbnb, when I typed in Airbnb and neighbors, it was a fairly long laundry list of complaints and different kind of issues that neighbors have had and news articles written on parties and destruction of homes and everything to that effect. So there is two fairly prevalent arguments for short-term rentals. And all of these issues that we heard at the last PAC meeting, a lot of them to me seemed like there was an absence of enforcement for accountability of these hosts with the short-term rentals. So issues pertaining to like investment of from outside of Modal and misuse of property, all of these are issues of accountability. And a lot of the solutions that are imposed from other municipalities and cities across the country, like Vancouver, Toronto, Ottawa, and Victoria and Kelowna, they all kind of enforced accountability within their bylaws and their solutions to all these problems. So a lot of the solutions are a person may only have short-term business license in the residence where they live. Again, occupants, principal residence in Toronto. Residents may only rent their primary residence in Ottawa. Again, principal residence, owner occupied. And moving on to like the nuisance calls for emergency services. In Kelowna is a fairly interesting policy where they only permit two adults to reside in a short-term rental, so it kind of cuts down the condensation for parties and any more excessive use.
Mr. Warnell, I have a question on that. When you say principal residence, do you mean principal residence as we would look in terms of like a Canadian Revenue Agency definition, or principal residence that the person really lives there?
The person really lives there.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So short-term rentals will change the dynamics of the community and don't provide any real contribution to the housing need model. This was a fairly interesting question because we see change in dynamics of these communities as a fairly complex issue. There's things are always changing in communities. There is always a need for change, and I think change kind of fosters growth within a community. So we look at the things like population, the aging population, vulnerable population, employment, housing, transportation, climate, business, these things are never stagnant. They're kind of constantly changing. So when we look at the need for short-term rentals and thinking of that, the concept of shame of a land use, I think it's fairly important to keep an open mind and be fairly progressive about these kind of issues. And moving through the question to looking at short-term rentals don't provide any contribution to the housing need. They do in kind of a dynamic way. However, we've already seen some statistics here in Modal. They do hamper the long-term rental stock quite a bit. Just some final thoughts. I'm hoping you guys have some comments after. But Modal short-term rental entire homes occupies 20% of the available rental units in Modal. Entire home short-term rentals are the ones that are depleting long-term rental stock in Nova Scotia municipalities. The Terra in Nova Scotia has enabled short-term rental growth within the province of Nova Scotia. In enforcement of bylaws focusing on accountability in lieu of prohibition might improve this kind of land use. And this most definitely is not a Modal-specific issue. Thank you.
I have a question by Mayor Bolivar-Gatson.
I don't know if it's a question or a comment, and I guess you're right. This definitely isn't a Modal specific problem. It's something that's been going on throughout the provinces for several years now. And that being 2016, that data, it definitely has drastically increased over the course of the last few years. We have people who that is their business, to buy homes and to put them on the market for short-term rental. And I guess in conversation with some of the other mayors in the area, I guess there may be a need for some of that, but it definitely shouldn't be to the extent that it is, or they should be taxed commercial. There should be a different way of looking at this. But under the MGA, we are very limited as to what we can do at this point in time. Now, I have heard through different commentary the current premier state that they are looking at short-term rentals, Airbnbs, whatever the category may be, and how they're going to address, and again, I believe that statement was that there is room for some of these, but that we do have to look at what's going on. Now, in Prince Edward Island, in Charlottetown specific, I guess, they do have a bylaw, and they only allow a certain percentage of the home to be rented out for a certain period of time. So it has to be a primary residence, and you're supposed to be living in a 50% or something. You can look at it, but I know that that is the case because it's been the topic on the Atlantic Mayor's agenda now for the last probably 3 or 4 years, and it's a standing item. So to think that we're the only ones dealing with it, no. And one of the things that we've been trying to do within Lunenburg County is to take a regional approach so that hopefully whatever we decide to do will mirror our neighbors as well. So that's the approach we've been looking at.
Mr. Warnell, did you have a comment?
No.
There's a question by Councillor DeLong.
Thank you. Through the chair, do you feel that within this discussion there's any place for talk about whether the like Airbnb and these other corporate entities have any social responsibility? If like they have rules and regulations in their own policies, but I don't feel like you see in the news every other week somebody's house gets trashed by Airbnb renters. So do you think that there's any room in the conversation for what those rental agencies ought to be doing to actually enforce things? Because how are we going to send a bylaw enforcement officer out to deal with any complaints that we have on short-term rentals?
Mr. Warnell?
Thank you for your comment. I think it's fairly interesting that you mentioned the short-term rental platforms taking responsibility for the renters in these buildings. In Victoria and the City of Vancouver, each short-term rental must be registered with an identification number with the platform host, and that kind of enforces accountability through the platform host to license all of these short-term rentals. And in turn, they do enforce more of an insurance kind of platform for these kind of situations where people are going in and trashing these homes. And so if the penalties for any infractions as well on these short-term rental platforms is a complete termination of any kind of contracts, and then you are unable to participate in any sort of short-term rental businesses within their communities. So,
if I may, Madam Chair, supplementary, I feel like the responsibility should lie with the corporate entities. So I'm just wondering what we as a municipality can do to make sure that they are enforcing their own rules.
Mr. Warren?
If you have any thoughts on that. I mean, I don't want to put you on the hot seat there.
As far as what we've talked about, the municipality's hands are very much so tied in these kind of regulatory issues. So I think it does rely on the province. It was the province of British Columbia that went to these large corporations like Airbnb and Vrbo that kind of implemented these kind of enforcements, and they said, this is the way we have to do it. This is the only way we can do it. And then, of course, the platform operator just okayed. And that's how they had to go about enforcing it. So there are possibilities and avenues. I believe provincially it's already been proven that it can happen.
Thank you, Mr. Warnell. Councillor Oracle.
Thank you very much. And through the chair, are the statistics just about renting short-term rentals of a whole house, or do they also include an actual B&B, where it's just a room within a house?
Mr. Warnell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. All the statistics and the data that I've shown were entire home rentals. So through the research that I found, there's a professor, his name is David Watchmuth, who is from McGill University, and he kind of spearheads a lot of this kind of short-term rental research and the regulatory framework around short-term rentals and everything to that effect. And he identified the entire home short-term rental as kind of the hot-button issue or the culprit that's taking all of these large-scale rental units off of the market for the long-term rentals. So that's primarily what I focused a lot of my data and all my numbers on, is the entire home short-term rentals.
Thank you, Mr. Warnell. Is there any other questions or comments?
I don't see any comments on Facebook at this time.
Thank you. Yes, Councillor Oikle, there's a question.
I guess it's a question. But I'm wondering when we come to a point where we're going to make policies or bylaws or whatever regarding short-term rentals, would we need to specify the difference between the whole house and then people who have bed and breakfasts? Because that's also a short term, right? You know, I'm just wondering what you think on that, or even our planning department, what they think.
Mr. Warnell, first, I guess.
And one of you gentlemen, feel free to take this. But if we look at what Vancouver did with that situation, do you want to take this?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Craig. When we get to the definitions section, when we move this MODL 2040 a little further forward, delve back into the housing policy section, but yeah, setting up specific definitions for Airbnbs versus other types of short-term rentals that I can't think of the name of right now, but setting out a selection of definitions that target specifically what council wants to do with these policies and the kind of thresholds that you want to see and their effect on other types of housing availability. I think those are all good things to do in the near future. So I think that'll come within the next 8 months or so, that they'll get another chance to get down and write some definitions out and debate those as well. So
Thank you, Mr. Shoup, and I think Mr. King has a comment.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. So just echoing what our planning department has stated, that once we get to the actual nitty-gritty detail, we should absolutely have a clear definition of what type of short-term rental accommodation we're talking about. Because it goes back, so I'm the one who suggested the guilt versus shame principle. But the core principle is that not all short-term rental accommodation are evil or bad or villain, right? So we need to identify the problem and we need to focus on solving the problem. And if there's a certain short-term rental accommodation that do not really cause as much problem as the other type, then we should definitely address that so that when we talk about drafting land use policy or land use bylaw, we need to make sure that we don't penalize any innocent, landowner or developer who's not really causing the problem, but everyone just gets grouped into one single thing. So I agree that once the council gets to the point where we need to have this type of housing and short-term rental discussion, we should definitely clarify the definition and then and talk about enforcement. And a little bit about enforcement, staff is also working on the implementation portion of the land use bylaw in general, because planners in the council could write or adopt and approve the housing policies, but if the implementation if the tool's not there, then the policy is not really effective because no one's going to follow it if we don't implement it or enforce it. So staff is also concurrently working on the creation of the enforcement bylaw. So although our approaches has been the education portion, because a lot of the time when there's a violation of the land use bylaw, people didn't know. They just didn't know the rule. They just didn't know that there's something called land use bylaw that existed. And typically, and our goal again is for compliance, education, awareness of people that these are the things that you can do with your land, and these are the things that you cannot do with your land. And if you wish to do something that's not permitted in your land, well, here's a process for appeal or amendments to the bylaw. And typically, that's 80% of the problem would be resolved in that way. Having said that, there's the other 20% who is completely aware of the council's intention and what the public good is, what the land use bylaw states, but aware that they are not decided to follow, even though they know the rule. So that's why staff is also currently working on the enforcement bylaw, so as to basically state that, okay, for that 20% of people who choose not to follow the rule, what are we going to do? Because there's as much as we don't want to penalize anyone, there's got to be some teeth to it with the land use bylaw, including short-term rental policies, so that just in case things go at the worst-case scenario, we have some plans, plan B, C, and D to follow through. So staff is trying to approach on different angles. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Now we have a question here by Mr. Macruck.
Through the chair, my understanding is that there's a conclusion that short-term rentals come at the expense of long-term rentals, but I would think a large percentage of these short-term rentals are simply summer homes, vacation homes of families who, if they could not use them as short-term rentals, would not be using them as long-term rentals. So the question is, what percentage of these short-term rentals in reality would be used as long-term rentals if they couldn't be used for short-term?
Mr. Wardle, can you answer that? It's a good question.
It is a great question. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And look at these kind of issues we just discussed, defining different uses and different strategies on defining these different kinds of short-term rentals. And that's one of the things that I found in my research. There's a fairly substantial gap in the data that kind of defines what a structure or a home is used for at this point. So we can't really make the distinction between a summer home or what have you, or something purpose-built for Airbnb at this point. All I could do was look at the data provided from the AirDNA website.
Thank you very much. And there's a question with Councillor DeLong.
Thank you. Just for clarification, going back to Councillor Oikle's question about B&Bs versus short-term rentals, wouldn't a B&B owner have a business license? So wouldn't that be classified as something completely different other than, well, I mean, it's still a short-term rental, but they're operating their building as a business.
Mr. Wardle? Or Mr. King, it looks like he's eager.
I could take that. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, yes, it is too. So there are certain commercial businesses that require we don't have municipal license, but there is a provincial license for, because technically a hotel is also could be considered as short-term rental. Depends on the definition. It's hotel, motel, B&B, things like that. So once the council and the PAC gets to the point, okay, what's the definition of short-term rental that we're concerned about? One of the possible ways that the committee and the council could recommend that, okay, well, those who have commercial licenses from the province, you may be exempt from this certain short-term rental policy. That could definitely be one way. I think that's a good distinction to be made. So, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. And there's a question, Councillor Staton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. You mentioned, and I'm not sure, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Perfect. Yong Jung mentioned enforcement. And I just wonder how or what your thought process is behind that. Because when I tried to do a noise and nuisance bylaw, it went to the police advisory board, and they come back saying that because we don't have a bylaw, the police will not enforce nuisance and noise complaints, or they will not even visit nuisance and noise complaints unless they know there's alcohol or drugs involved. So how do you see an enforcement bylaw working in this case when we don't have a noise and nuisance bylaw?
Mr. King, would you like to answer that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and through you and to Council Stanton. So thank you for the question. It is true. So this specific example for noise and nuisance bylaw, you're right that unless council has that bylaw enacted, the local police does not have authority to enforce, as there is no bylaw stating that noise and nuisance is some type of violation. So for the enforcement bylaw that I have mentioned, the little bit before is that is in terms of the land use bylaw and the building bylaw. So we have many rules on in the land use and building or what you can and cannot do. And then if we detect any type of violation. So, for example, the structure is not up to the code or someone try to do a short-term rental hosting in office village where it is zoned as medium or high density where it is not permitted. So that's considered as a land use bylaw violation. And in all the municipality, the development officer would be responsible for enforcing. Now, having said that, especially in a rural area, it is very challenging to physically for municipal staff to go around the areas and try to, quote unquote, catch people. It's really difficult. So, of course, this staff is currently at the very initial discussion of how do we realistically enforce all these bylaws while we're not putting a burden on our municipal finances. So, of course, one of the ideas is that and this is what's done in other rural municipality in Nova Scotia is that as a lot of the rural municipality completely rely on the complaint basis. So, while the municipal staff would not actively go around for inspection, there will be a tool or some kind of a platform where the neighbors would if have a complaint, they would forward that with, of course, certain requirements to follow, such as a little bit of evidences or timestamps, things like that, that we forwarded to our development office, and then we will follow. Of course, it will not be able to detect all of the violation because, again, we're relying on neighbors, reporting. Just realistically, because it's been done a lot in rural Nova Scotia because it's a balance between, municipal human resource and the financing versus a large, vast amount of land as well as, the effective use of, both energy, money, and time of the municipal government. Now, so to wrap this question up, basically staff is currently just studying options as what a municipality could do, and then eventually it would have to be a discussion at the council level. So we will follow up in the later time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. And Mr. Councillor Stanton, do you have a follow-up comment?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Councillor Oikle.
Just back to what I had mentioned before and what Councillor DeLong mentioned. I just found on the website because I thought for registering your tourist accommodation for Nova Scotia, it says that you don't have to register your tourist accommodation if it is your primary residence. For example, a room in your primary residence or a bed and breakfast that is also your primary residence. You do not need to register it. So just for that information for you.
Thank you, Councillor Oikle. Does anyone have any other comments or questions? Oh, there's a comment or question from Mr. Hagel.
Thank you very much. Through the chair there, I have a question. What we don't seem to hear or discuss a lot is the impact that this has to some of our neighbors. I live in a very rural cottage area and actually had conversations with both full-time residents and seasonal residents on this. And from where I live anyway, there's not a lot of support for this because the full-time residents, I mean, like myself, I would say if I wanted to live next to a hotel, I would have moved in town. So when I bought this property, however many years ago, it was not the intention. And that's why I moved here full-time. The summer residents feel they come here to relax and enjoy it. And they feel that peace and quiet is mostly observed by the neighbors who have a stake in the ground here and respect everybody else's privileges. So getting into this B&B area where, there's bed and breakfast thing, even in a rural area like this, it's just where I understand it's hard just to say no, it can't be allowed, and there's is some ways of managing this, like the primary residence thing, and putting a lot more accountability back on the people who are renting these things, rather than them just renting their apartment and or their cottage and going to Halifax and leaving it for the neighbors to deal with. Anyway, I'm very concerned with it, have been all along, just because I know a few bad apples seem to spoil it for everybody else, and not everybody will come into an area and, you know, party their heads off. That's not to say that, but I'm really concerned over adjoining property owners. And something I've always felt with is when you're planning a change in an area, you should be very cognizant of the existing lifestyles of the people who have lived there for years. And in this case, where we all acknowledge there's issues regarding how to manage it, would be the right way to say it. It just compounds the problems for residents that are here today paying taxes and are good citizens of MODL. And this has some impact on the long-term rental properties within the area. So anyway, I can't say no, that I would never accept it, because that's just not right. But I would definitely like to see the policies and practices put in place not to to affect the existing property owners. That's a real concern of mine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hagel. Is there a comment you'd like to make, Mr. Warnow?
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Hagel, I can definitely identify with you. I live in a rural community in Prospect Bay, and both of my neighbors on either side are short-term rentals. And we do have these individuals that come down and like to party by the water. They make all kinds of noise. They bother my dog. They bother me. So I can definitely identify with you. And I do think there needs to be some sort of provision put in place for this as well.
Thank you, Mr. Warnell. And Mr. Hagel, do you have a follow-up comment? Or?
No, I don't. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I see we have a question or comment by Mr. Macrock.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Wordle, if I'm pronouncing your name properly. There's been much said tonight that comes across, at least to me, as a negative criticism of these short-term rentals, but presumably they exist because they satisfy a need. There must be a positive impact on the community, if not, you know, the business community per se, with the restaurants and shops and so forth in Chester, Mahone Bay, Lunenburg, and so forth. My question is, could you highlight some of these positive benefits of these short-term rentals?
Thank you, Mr. Macrick. Mr. Warnell, would you like to answer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I most certainly can. I think first and foremost, I've been putting a lot of thought into this because I kind of thought this question might come up. But if we think about the benefits to a municipality, if there's provisions put in place for like taxable revenue generated through these short-term industries, mind you, it's not it's not very large at the moment, but there is opportunity for growth. And I do believe that a lot of these short-term rental properties, they do provide a fairly positive economic benefit for the small businesses in a community, like places like Mahone Bay, where there's a lot large commercial waterfront. Mind you, it's obviously not modal, but there's also a lot of provisions for that, just for benefits for small businesses. So those are the two major aspects that I can see.
Thank you very much, Mr. Warnell. There's a comment from Councillor Creek.
Thank you, Chair. Just the one major complaint I hear, other than noise regarding short-term rentals, is when renters leave and leaving their waste either on the property or missorted because they're not from our municipality, so they don't know how to properly sort the waste out by the road 10 days early for animals to get into. That I just want to highlight that that's a complaint that I hear frequently throughout the summer as a councillor in a rural area with a lot of short-term rentals on the lake.
Thank you, Councillor Greek. I have a comment that, because I noticed that nobody mentioned this. So I had Airbnb next to me this summer, and I found it scary. And I'm not too sure that nobody else seems to say this, but it's scary. And it's not like they were bad people, because they weren't. But all of a sudden, you were locking your door and being a bit more cognizant of stuff and kind of, you know, shutting your curtains and stuff that you never do because you know those people. And, you know, I found it strange. And I just thought it would be worth saying because I'm sure I'm not the only person who lives by themselves in the country. And it, yeah, like I said, like that worries the dog. Like all of a sudden, everything's kind of thrown off. And I know it sounds a little bit silly, but I found it a little bit hard on the head. So, anyways, that's just a comment. And Mr. Hagel, do you have another question or comment?
Just a comment. I should have said regarding short-term rentals or Airbnbs. I just want to go on the record of saying. Establishments like Bed and Breakfast in Mahone Bay, I'm fully in agreement with that type of establishment. They're in kind of a commercial area, and it's a business environment. And if they want to rent out one unit or one room to people, like I'm not in favor of that at all. Where I have the issue is more in residential areas.
Thank you, Mr. Hagel. Is there any, did you want to make a comment, Mr. Kang?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. So that's a really good point. And this is a great opportunity for the PAC members and the council to have a influencing voice into this, because this is exactly why we're having a land use bylaw, because land use bylaw, it's basically, once we get to the zoning map, it's saying, because we need to recognize that there are some places where short-term rentals are appropriate. There are also other areas where short-term rentals are not really appropriate. And through zoning and the land use bylaw, this is where the council has, like, our intention for short-term rental is this, this, and this. And then we plan to implement it by this zoning map and the land use bylaw. So as this MODL 2040 is moving forward, and the PAC members and the council would definitely have a say into where are places where short-term rentals like Airbnb would be more appropriate than the other, right? And then there's that. And so the location is also one factor. Scale is also another factor. There are short-term rentals that we don't even notice that they exist. There are other short-term rental accommodation that are excessively noticeable through, say, noises at 2 in the morning, or trashes after the weekend, or like a on-street parking, say, on a narrow private road. It would be somewhere way too noticeable. And we should definitely recognize that, because we should definitely recognize that people, especially the permanent resident who's been there already, who purchased the property so they can enjoy the quiet the neighborhood by the lake or stream or coast, right? So again, it's perfectly fitting for the MODL 2040 project. It's all about the balance. It's because there's we should try not to go to the one or the other the extreme way. We need to find a balance, and that balance would be it should be discussed at the PAC and the council level. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King and Mayor Bolivar Getson.
Thank you. I guess again. I'm going to go back to something that James, I believe it was James, said earlier, and that we're deeming all short-term rentals in a negative. And I disagree with that. I really disagree with that. I guess I've used short-term rentals on many occasions. Traveling with a family the size of my family, you need almost a floor in a hotel. So we usually rent a home wherever we go. I just returned from Mount Tremblant, Quebec City. We rented homes, is what we rented. There was 11 of us. I had a 3-year-old, a 7-year-old, 13, 16-year-old with me. They're not all party venues, I guess is the point that I would like to get across. I've rented them down in the States probably for over 20, 30 years, the VRBO, Vacation Rental By Owner, I think it stands for. These are venues that, like I said, many people use. It's newer to our area. It does need some regulations around it. But I really don't believe by putting regulations in place that you're going to see these homes opened up for long-term rentals. A lot of people use them when they travel to, they come to these vacation spots for 3-4 months out of a year. They rent them out. They use property of, I don't know what the word it is, where they take care of your property for you, maintenance, whatever, companies that take care of them. They're very strict. They're very strict. You pay high deposits. You do whatever to do this. And it's your reputation, even if I want to rent again in another area. I don't want me to have that bad mark by my name that I'm not able to rent again. So they do come with regulations in other areas, and you are able to do this. Yes, there are some homes being bought up in our area just for short-term rentals. There's no question. A lot of them around water lakes, the ocean, so on, that are more favorable for vacation-type spots. But they are used for other purposes as well. So I think we got to find that balance and what that balance is. It's definitely not all or nothing. I think that there is a middle ground that can be had here with the proper regulations put in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Bolivar-Getson. Is there any other questions or comments? Okay, with that, I'd like to thank very much Mr. Warnell for coming here and giving this very informative presentation, giving us lots to think about, different statistics and everything. It was very well done and much appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So on to six Planning Advisory Committee matters.
There's no other items under six or seven or eight or nine.
So the next meeting date is Thursday, April 28th at 2022. Before we adjourn, also I want to mention a couple other things that Kathleen Long Gray sends her regrets for this evening. And talking about changes and people moving, I'd also like to thank on behalf of the Planning Advisory Committee, Mr. Shoup and Mr. Kang, as they are moving on, and we wish them all the very best, and thank you very much for your hard work and dedication. It's been a pleasure working with you. And with that, I need someone to make a motion to adjourn. Oh, yes. Councillor Oikle?
No, I moved to adjourn the meeting.
And seconder is Councillor DeLong. All in favor? Online?
Yes.
And so no opposed. So the motion is passed to adjourn. Have a good evening. Thank you.